You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Well, hello out there in Archaeology Podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, for episode 167. And we're blessed and honored and gifted to have with us a gentleman who will be talking about his research and a book that he published and his reflections on his lifetime of, I'd say, tours or treks throughout the Baja Peninsula to see those great mural rock art figures. Alan, are you there?
I am here. Happy to be so.
Oh, God bless you for gracing our humble association. So, of course, the million-dollar question is, how the heck did you get involved with any of this stuff to begin with? Was it a lifetime passion, or was it something in your childhood? How did you get connected with this kind of a dalliance? How's that?
Well, I think as far as Baja California is concerned, our family, kind of an extended family, the three gentlemen that hiked Baja California, myself and two others, were actually the sons of three different Caltech engineers. And
wow.
they love trekking to Baja California in their Suburbans and, you know, Land Cruisers.
Right.
And we never, ever got into the mountains specifically. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Highway 1 and the offset of roads that we often took to the beaches and to the coves on both the Pacific and Gulf side basically did not run through or over or along any of the 7 or 8 mountain ranges the length of the Baja Peninsula. And I always felt like I was left out, that there was some adventure, something to see in those mountains, and it just could not be done by car or by road, even four-wheel drive for the most part. And so that kind of stuck with me until I was in college. I went to UC Riverside. When I was 21, I hiked the length of the Pacific Crest Trail, backpacked Pacific Crest Trail, and it had a major change on my view of both myself and the world. And I changed from pre-med into a conservation biology program because of it. I liked the outdoors. I wanted to be in the outdoors. And by the time I was finished with the Pacific Crest Trail, I started thinking about Baja California as an extension of the Sierra Nevada. And that, gosh, wouldn't it be great if we could somehow manage to see a trail extend all the way down to Cabo San Lucas at the tip. Mm-hmm. And I started studying that. And of course, you run into, you know, the original trail, El Camino Real, which is still, for the most part, between Loreto and San Diego, you know, still visible or still not easily found, but traceable.
Yeah, hikeable too.
And hikeable. And, you know, I have this thing now for Jesuit Padres who like a very straight trail.
Uh-huh.
You know, they have some good things going for them. At any rate, in 1974, I decided that the year after I hiked the Pacific Crest Trail, I decided it's time to hike Baja California. So one of my graduate advisors was a man named Homer Ashman.
Yeah.
Who wrote the Natural Ecology and Demography of the Central Desert of Baja California.
Mm-hmm.
And I started talking to him about that, and he wasn't particularly positive about hiking the length.
He thought you'd lost your mind, right?
Yeah. But he wasn't a hiker. He was a fisherman.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But, you know, his book was fascinating to me, and I started to begin to learn about 7 or 8 different linguistic tribal groups in Baja California. And it just, the history and the prehistory began to kind of suck me in. And I got more and more excited about hiking the length and started planning how to do it. The idea was to drive down from the U.S. border with about 25 5-gallon steel cans packed with backpacking foods that we would bury on our way down to Cabo San Lucas.
Wow.
The best topo map we had was a scale of 1 to 250,000. Oh. It was a pretty poor map, but it was the best we could find. And we did take that with us, and we made notations where surface water was likely to be, or where we did find it, and where it was not, and where we had to kind of watch our P's and Q's on the hike north in terms of water. And we started hiking north from Cabo San Lucas on March 3rd. And of course, started with the Sierra del Cabo, and then into the Sierra Giganta that stretches from La Paz to Loreto. Mm-hmm. And then in the Sierra Guadalupe, the Sierra San Francisco, and on. And we found rock art in every single mountain range, but by far the great mural area of the Sierra Guadalupe and the Sierra San Francisco, both south and north of San Ignacio, was by far, I found, the most mind-boggling set of murals and artwork that I had ever seen. Not that there wasn't fascinating artwork elsewhere. There are a lot of petroglyphs that have not been discovered throughout the peninsula, and I'm sure smaller paintings as well. But the larger murals were just spectacular. And one of the paintings kind of spoke to me. We spent a whole day looking at it, studying it.
Which was that?
It was Cueva de la Cuesta Palmarito.
Yes,
which
yes.
In the south, I'd say the southeastern portion of the Sierra San Francisco, near a little pueblo called Santa Marta.
Yes.
And that at the top, at the apex of that painting, is a man, a woman, I think both shaman, and a mountain lion, a larger than life-size mountain lion. And this was at the very apex, the top part of the painting, of the mural. And I am one of those that believes that the newer portions of the painting were always at the very upper echelons of the mural. They were probably the last to be painted for a number of reasons. But those three figures spoke to me, and it became the initial seed to the book that I wrote.
Okay. No, but what was it that captivated you so much about those particular elements of that panel?
I think it's both the position and the content. The position, of course, is sort of not only the newest, but it's kind of highlights. It oversees the rest of the mural.
Right.
And it's like being on the front page of the New York Times for a month in the era of the 1400s, 1500s.
Yeah. So it's at the apex, right? At the most prominent point at the top. So it's kind of envisioning or somehow heraldic elements to them. Am I correct or no?
You're correct. In my mind.
Yeah.
And the association of the man, the woman, and the mountain lion intrigued me because, mountain lion are, I mean, it's the apex predator in Baja California.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely.
And as you know, the ranchers that live there now, that live with 300 goat herds, making cheese in the backcountry, the biggest fear they have is of the mountain lion population.
Sure, sure.
But to have that association of the three, the man, the woman, and the mountain lion, it just intrigued me so much. And the first 5-6 chapters of my book are essentially about the man and the woman and the mountain lion that brought them together.
Wow. That's wonderful. Very wonderful. You saw a lot of the great mural rock art, and I guess that was scattered, certainly, throughout your trip. Now, there is some controversy about what the oldest or what the source of that material is. Some thought it was the Sierra de San Francisco, but the author of The D-Stretch has written a kind of an online article, or maybe it's published now, about a different way of thinking about it. He thinks there's other elements of that tradition that are either older or began in that were, the seeds of that tradition. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
My feeling is those murals are some of the more recent paintings in Baja California. They're, as you know, as you go south of the Sierra Guadalupe and north of the Sierra San Francisco, the painting becomes more not representational, but abstract.
More abstract, yeah. Yeah.
And there are some places where there are, I think, fairly young or recent paintings, but I don't know. It seems like the great murals of the Sierra San Francisco and Guadalupe was the after. I mean, it was the blooming of the architectural genius of the indigenous populations that was well grounded in the earlier works that may have preceded the great murals by as much as 1,000 years.
Okay. So,
but that's just my intuition.
Yeah, no. But do you then mean that the abstract, non-representational, non-naturalistic would be the earlier material or later? Or are they independent traditions?
I think it would have been the earlier material.
Okay. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that those students of this who have studied it and dated those images and looked at the superimposition of those materials find that the underlying initial development of the tradition was with those simple abstract figures. So that's interesting to me.
So the most recent figures actually record the coming of the missionaries. And we have seen, I know personally, of two caves or two rock shelters, murals, that have incorporated in a yellow paint, yellowish, goldish paint, you know, the Roman crosses, the Catholic crosses.
Yeah.
And they're small collections.
But they're,
and they
tend
to be
there, right?
Tucked kind of deep into a corner of the mural or the painting.
Yeah.
They are certainly
there,
not
right?
highlighted by any means.
No, but they're there, huh?
But they're there. And there's another painting that I don't think is well known, but in the Sierra, in the southern portion of the Sierra Juarez, just south of the border, and I'm trying to remember the name of the ranch, but the ranch owner that owned that ranch pointed it out to us. And it was the only painting that we have ever seen in Baja California of horseback riders. Men riding horses. And I believe, you know, it dates back to about the 1700s.
Sure.
There is a record of, I'm trying to remember his name, the conquistador or explorer that came from essentially Arizona, Yuma, crossed at Yuma at the river, Colorado River, dipped down into the Sierra Juarez, and then went all the way on up to Mission San Francisco, bringing livestock and colonists with him. And so we know that there are paintings that are, you know, a few hundred years old. How old are the oldest? That's a good question. The only dating that I am aware of was done by Clement Meehan of a painting in the Sierra San Francisco. I think it was called Cueva Pintada. And I think he came up with somewhere around 550 years of age. But that was done, I think, on some carbon fragments in the midden of the cave itself. But I think that's probably, in my opinion, again, a pretty good, you know, middle date for some of the paintings in the Sierra San Francisco.
Okay. You said you trekked across the Baja Peninsula a number of times, right?
Well, we initially hiked the length. We started in Cabo San Lucas, went through the Sierra del Cabo.
That was the first time.
Yeah.
And did you do it again?
Well, once I completed that, along with my half-brother and a friend, we did a few lectures at college campuses and, you know, Sierra Club chapters, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And we picked up a group that really wanted us to take them down to see the cave.
I see.
It became the beginning of a business enterprise. It was essentially a wilderness travel business.
Sure.
We did a lot of different recreational activities.
That's great.
Everything from Africa to Southeast Asia.
Oh, my word.
But we did probably a half a dozen trips in Baja California every year.
Let me stop you there. It's a good time to stop for the first segment. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, gang. This is segment two. You're on episode 167 and listening to Dr. Alan Garfinkel with an interview with Alan Urgot, about his adventures in Baja California. So, Alan, you've written a book about this subject, but in a very unusual way. And I think you want to really discuss or drill down on the ecological relationships of the native people, both with the land and the landscape, and also the missionaries. Am I correct?
Yeah, I found that to be very interesting and a subject that not too many people know.
Yeah, and I would agree wholeheartedly. I think the ecological relationship is one that would certainly interest a lot of our listeners. I don't think they really understand or appreciate the nature of this region. So please spend some time and try to paint a word picture about it.
Well, the Baja California Peninsula is about 800 miles long. And as I mentioned, it has, by my count, eight mountain ranges, small mountain ranges, running the length from the U.S. border all the way to its tip at Cabo San Lucas. In the very northern part of Baja California, in the Sierra Juarez and the Sierra San Pedro March, these are extensions of the San Gabriel and Santa Rosa Mountains in the southern part of the state of California. And these are mountains that are 6,000 all the way up to 10,000 feet in altitude and elevation. And the National Observatory is there in the Sierra San Pedro March here. And there are plateaus of pine, ponderosa pine, and, throughout. Matter of fact, there's even a logging operation in the Sierra Juarez. So it's very similar to what you would see in the mountains of Southern and Central California. As you pass south, then you get into the Sierra San Borja and, the southern mountain range that are essentially surrounded by desert and that do not receive a lot of rain. There are periods of time where, for instance, the Vizcayano Desert, just north of the central part of, well, actually at the central part of Baja California, but north of San Ignacio, sometimes it doesn't receive any rain for 4 years, 3 or 4 or 5 years. And so it's very dry. When it does get rain, it gets a little bit sometimes from a northern storm that sweeps down from Alta or Upper California and then hits this desert before it peters out. But most of its rain actually comes from the tropical storms, what they call the chubascos, that come up from mainland Mexico up through the Sea of Cortez or the Gulf of California. And sometimes there are torrential rains that hit the mountain, the Sierra San Francisco, the Sierra San Borja and the Sierra Guadalupe, and you see a lot of flash flooding in these broad, expansive arroyos that come out of the mountains and into the desert flats. So you see boulders, huge rock fields of rounded, tumbled boulders that come out of these mountains. And so you know that the large amounts of rain happen. But by and large, they also have long, extended drought periods. And so the vegetation, as diverse it is, does not support a lot of wildlife. So, for instance, hunters, and we're talking about the native Californians as being simply hunters and gatherers, they were desert dwellers as well. And so they could not rely on large populations of deer or, the more common hunted animals that you might find in the upper state of California. There are some bighorn sheep, borrego. There are some antelope, pronghorn antelope in the northern parts of Baja California. And throughout Baja California, in all of the Sierras, there are deer. And in most of the cave paintings that we just talked about, deer are one of the more prominent figures in the murals. And it's very clear that was a difficult food type to hunt, but one that they definitely admired. I mean, it was like, well, the next common food source for the Indians was agave, the hearts of agave, which had to be roasted in underground pits for 2 days. And is very stringy, very tough. But after 2 days of roasting, you got this kind of very sweet, something like artichokes. And I've heard people say that it's like sucking molasses off of a whisk broom.
Wow.
That was
quite a description.
It was the most common for the native, you know, indigenous peoples of Baja
California. Yeah.
There are some oak forests down there. The pinion nuts that were found in, or pine nuts that were found in the Sierra San Pedro Martir and the Sierra Juarez at the very north were also incorporated and traded extensively throughout Baja California. And there were fish products. The peninsula, of course, is bordered by the Pacific Ocean to the west and the Gulf of California to the east. But herein lies the problem. There are very few water sources along the coast. And so the natives that fished or found marine life of any kind, shells, so immediately after heavy rains, where there still was water, you know, deposited in little rocky basins where they could actually survive off that water. But ultimately, they had to go back into the mountains where the year-round water sources were and where their encampments or their rancherias were found. So it was a hard, tough life. Another common food source were cactus fruit. One in particular is, oh my gosh, just black.
Called pitaya, right?
Pitaya. Oh, thank you very much. It's like an Oregon pipe cactus fruit, pitaya dulce, which is very much about the size of maybe two or three golf balls, red, and it has an amazing sweet, juicy taste like watermelon. That's about the closest I can come to it on the inside. But that cactus fruited in August, September during a very short period of time. But even the missionaries, the Jesuit padres that came in the late 1600s, or settled in the late 1600s, described that as the only time of the year where the Indians felt that they were well fed, that they could find enough nourishment to the point where they weren't hungry. And most of their festivities, times where villages visited each other, were done during the pitaya harvest, where it was much easier to find the sustenance to support them. So here come the conquistadors after Mexico City was conquered, essentially, by Hernan Cortez in 1522, 23, 24, in that era. Hernan actually stumbled on quite a very wealthy civilization, and it just encouraged him. He wanted to go further north. And in 1524, he wrote a letter to the king, asking for his support in extending his conquest further north to an island, which he later called California. And I won't go into the story of how California got its name unless you really want to. But the first European to step foot on the peninsula of California, on what they called the island of California, was in 1534. And he was a navigator that actually mutinied from the captain, who was a relative of Cortez. And he was Basque, and his supporters were Basque, and they landed at a spot that is believed to be La Paz, Baja California, at the southern, near the southern tip, or at least in the Cape region. From that point, they learned that there were natives in Baja California, that they were pearl divers, that they had, they could sustain themselves. They did not, from what they could see, have gold or silver, but they wore a fairly sizable bead collection of pearls. And so this encouraged Cortez himself, and the next expedition he himself captained and manned. And in 1535, La Paz was the first attempt at colonization. What amazes me, and this is what I'm building up to, is that over the next 162 years, Spain repeatedly failed to colonize Baja California.
And interesting, huh?
It is interesting. And it's not due to the attempts. There were multiple attempts by Vizcaino, by a man named Otondo. And
what caused that failure, Counselor?
I think it was all of the above. And all of the above was, it took a lot of supplies and materials to get them to that state. They had to come from the Puerto Vallarta side, the western side of mainland Mexico. and bring their ships north against the wind, against the trades, and have enough to attempt colonization, because there certainly weren't the foodstuffs locally on site in California to support a colony.
No.
Secondly,
and to this very day, if I can interject, there's so few people that live down there in those little pueblitos, right?
Yes.
The little villages that they have. They have to be very independent people, and those that can get along in a particular environment that is rather non-conducive to human occupation. Do you agree?
Yes. They were intensely...
It's an intense place. From my few forays, not intimately known as much as you, I found the landscape and the territory itself to be so dangerous and egregious in terms of its difficulty to navigate, to just walk or... I mean, you can't use horses down there. You have to use mules.
Yes.
And even when you're on a mule, they have these little tiny thin trails. And the funny story that I tell is, you know, when we got to certain places on the backs of mules, right?
Yeah.
Where our guides, I always called them vaqueros or caballeros, right?
Yes.
Said, you need to get off your mule now. And I said, why? Says, it's too dangerous for the mule. Right? If it's too dangerous for the mule, what if it's dangerous for me?
Well, when you navigate those canyons, there are canyon walls that, you know, are 1,200 feet deep. And the trails go up and down these canyons. I mean, there's no choice. To see those mountains, you have to go up steeply and down steeply.
Exactly. And although I didn't navigate it on foot, I did navigate that particular region, almost exclusively Sierra de San Francisco, but I always called it the Grand Canyon of Mexico. And of course, I've got some very interesting stories about the dangers of trying to traverse those trails on the back of a mule with the burros following us and looking down and, you know, seeing it thousands of feet below, as you're aware.
Yeah.
It scared the hell out of me.
That's
if I could put it mildly. Go ahead.
Yeah, that does put it. Did me too.
Now, okay, good.
Hiking it, there are times when we had to carry 2.5 gallons of water with us, you know, to get to the next water point. And when you're doing that, trying to find a trail that sometimes you can't find, and you have to do it 2 or 3 or 4 times before you actually find the trail over the, you know, the right pass, you get a little unnerved.
And I think a little unnerved, yes.
And I think that happened to Doors, to the soldiers.
Yeah, come on.
That came to Mexico or to Baja California.
They didn't have the technology or the sophistication that we have. What kind of deal were they under? Can you imagine with the primitive associations they have? They had, you know, quite a tough road to hoe. Let's cut it off there and we'll pick it up on the next segment. See you later, gang. See you in the flip-flop. Welcome back, family. We're here with Alan Ergot talking about his adventures in the peninsula of Baja California and his reflections upon the landscape and also the relationship of the native people to the padres and discoverers of their culture. Alan, what's the message that you have for our audience? What is the takeaway from your adventures in the peninsula, please?
Well, let's start by the fact that when our young people, fourth graders, when they start learning about California history, it always starts with the missionary period and with Junipero Serra.
Right.
Who came from Loreto on his expansive journey northwards, and really the founding of what they consider to be the first mission at San Diego. Mm-hmm. Very little is known about the 250 years prior to that when the conquistadors started coming to California by way of the southern part of Baja California. And very few people understand that there were 17 missions established before San Diego Mission and the one at Monterey and or Carmel. So there's this history there that very few people understand. And it began with the conquistadors that pleaded with the indigenous natives of California to guide them around places to see what they could find in terms of resource values in Baja California. And you start reading the diaries of some of the conquistadors, soldiers, and the Jesuit padres that came with them. And the expeditions that the natives took them on, particularly one with Admiral Atondo across the peninsula to the Pacific on foot, took them to the very driest that, I mean, they chose to take them and show them the extensive water in the Comundú area. And they went by Comundú, which is a mission in a very extensive ranchera for the indigenous natives there in the Sierra Guadalupe. And they were leading the conquistadors and the padres on, basically saying, you don't want to live here. You don't want to come here. It's dry. We have a hard time just finding food on our own. If you come, there won't be food for any of us. And I think that was the message that lasted that 162 years from 1535 to 1697, when the Jesuits, not the soldiers, not Spain, but it was the Jesuits that started the first colony at Loreto. And it took them 70 years to step northwards, putting missions along El Camino Real towards the, what is now the upper state, Alta California. But it was a very tenuous, difficult process. And the crown, the king of Spain, lost the patience and found he didn't have the money to really support those missions. And it was only the ingenuity of the Jesuit padres in starting the Piety Fund of California. And this was a fund that was for people who had made money on the conquest of mainland Mexico, shipping gold, silver, you know, just resource, natural resources extracted by lucky people who benefited from it financially. Those were the people that the padres convinced them to give a stipend of 10,000 pesos, which at the time was a sufficient amount to start a single mission. It took the Jesuits 70 years before they were finally kicked out by the King of Spain, who became jealous of potentially hidden money on the part of the Jesuits or their quote-unquote desire to get rid of the King of Spain. And he became jealous and decided to boot them out of all of the colonies in the New World. And that's when the San Franciscans, the San Franciscan Padres took over in 1697. Let's see, 1769. And led, and that was when Junipero Serra led the expedition into upper the state of California to San Diego to start it. So for the first 250 years of California history, California included Arizona, Upper California, parts of Nevada. It was all considered an island of California. And it, the indigenous, even though they were hunters and gatherers, barely making it on their own in a very dry, arid environment, I think they pulled the wool over the Spanish eyes very well. And they at least kept them out for 162 years. And then they had a constant series of revolts at the missions that the Jesuit padres were successful in founding and kept them very busy and made it very difficult for them to advance further north into the upper parts of California.
Fascinating. Really amazing. I see what you're saying. Yeah, it is something that is not covered well in schools. But in general, I don't think that the education system does much in the way of deference to Native people, do they?
I don't believe so. Unfortunately, the only written history, and I put written in the quotes, from the Jesuit padres, there were a few, Beckard being one, that had kind of an anthropological sense about him and tried to view the natives in a neutral fashion.
Right.
But by and large, the descriptions were very demeaning, you know, describing the natives as having a lack of intelligence and a lack of breeding and, you know, just not sophisticated at all, and were surprised that they could survive, let alone have any kind of culture.
And, exactly.
That was one of the things that I tried to do in the book, is to say, hey, these people survived with what they had, and they did it well. And they got to a point where they exhibited their history in these murals, these painted murals in the sacred canyons of the Sierra San Francisco and Sierra Guadalupe that are astounding. They're probably some of the best artwork, indigenous artwork of that period in the world. And so, you know, they had smarts, they had intelligence, they had humor. There is one petroglyph panel that is in my book that, in my opinion, describes a tribal council that was notorious for having quacks and con men on it. And that it was like the first political cartoon on rock in a petroglyph form. And when I saw that, I said, now, these are smart people who did that. I mean, clearly they exist from one tribal group to others, which is really a meritocracy. You followed smart leaders, chiefs, shaman that knew what they were doing. But occasionally there were exceptions to the rule. And this was a petroglyph panel that demonstrated who their leaders were. And it was not a friendly depiction. And so, you know, there's so many different aspects when you find these rock art sites and you realize this is their history. This is who they were. These figurines that are painted and pecked into the rock and petroglyphs, these are real people and they have real histories and they did good things and they did bad things.
And the thing that always intrigues me about pictographs and petroglyphs and rock art in general, it's like a time capsule in part.
Yes.
You're looking at hundreds, if not thousands of years worth of the yearnings, the passions, the interaction, the visualization of their cosmology, their religion, what they felt was most important. And they communicated it in a way that was, for us looking at it now, very foreign, but also very dramatic, and sometimes overwhelmingly so. The beauty and the pictography, the visualization is sometimes so overwhelming, you don't know what to look at. You can look at the landscape in one, if you're in a rock shelter, and you see this amazing desert full of, you know, xeric plants that have adapted to this, you know, water deficient environment. And then you turn around and you see all these pictures on the rocks, and it is an overwhelming experience, isn't it?
I could not have said it better. Well said.
It is.
That's it's exactly the heart of the book.
It's something that touches your soul. For people that I've met and talked to and are close friends of mine who have studied the Great Mural Rock Art tradition for their lifetime, by the way, agree that this is something, it hooks you. It gets you and goes in your consciousness, and you can't forget about it. It just will not let you go. It won't, because these images, I think, touch us in a way that some conventional, you know, pictures do not. I mean, there's something about seeing these larger than life size images of animals and, you know, anthropomorphic, if I can use that term, you know, human-like figures, that just doesn't want to go away.
Yes. Well, if I may, I'd like to kind of center on one painting. It's in the very southern part of the Sierra San Francisco in the Arroyo El Barral, near a community of Santa Marta. And it's popularly called the Serpent Cave.
Mm-hmm.
And just to quickly describe it, it's a headlong collision between two serpents, undulating, rolling bodies strung out with antlered heads, very much like a buck. And you don't see antlered serpents this is the only place in the Southwest that I've seen this. But I've heard that there are some similar paintings in the Florida Southeast part of the United States. But one serpent has these figures of men and women and children, what the locals called monos,
M-O-N-O-S,
and along with wildlife. And clearly, it's a familiar serpent. It represents, in my opinion, the local Aboriginal tribe of California, or the people living in California.
Mm-hmm.
The second opposing serpent has a larger set of antlers, bigger mm-hmm. head, and virtually nothing around it.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that this collision, this represents the European versus the indigenous populations.
I see. Yeah.
Now, so, I could be wrong, and I'm just...
Right. But it gives you that flavor, right?
Yes. And it's not too far off. This could be a 400-year-old painting.
Sure. And as had some of my colleagues say, it's rock art, and you can interpret it, a myriad of ways. And I agree. I wasn't there. You weren't there. We haven't talked to the shamans or the artisans who, fashioned these images. And certainly a lot of this kind of material is open to just tremendous interpretive challenges. Okay.
Yes.
And I guess the one basis we have for understanding this kind of imagery is to look back to the ethnography and also the archaeologists that have spent considerable amounts of time asking themselves that same question. And there has been, quite a lot of material written and published about these images. But independent of that, it is still quite mysterious, and I could say that, confidently, in that these are some of the largest figures of animals and humans anywhere in the world. Am I correct?
I believe so.
Yeah, that's what they tell me. And so what caused the most depauperate people on the face of the planet, right, who couldn't even get some food to fill their bellies, to spend all this time painting these enormous pictures, right?
Yeah.
What kind of motivation would they have to have in their religious fervor to do this and spend this, radical amount of time producing these overwhelming images? What fueled their passions? So that's an important question, right?
I think so. In my mind, it's to tell their story.
Yeah, to tell their story, to commemorate their lives and to be a memorial. There's some things I pulled from my church attendance. It's a way to have personal immortality, right?
Very much so.
And these are images that, as you say, tell a story. And with that, I think we should close. Alan, I really want to thank you for an exciting and remarkable interchange. I hope you enjoyed it.
Well, it's been an honor. It's been an honor to talk to you, Alan, and you have such an extensive background in the Southwest anthropology, archaeological circles that it truly is an honor to talk to you about it.
God bless you. See you in your flip-flop, gang.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.